When Daniel Lipskin's plan, Memory Foundations, was selected as the winner of the 2003 World Trade Center Redesign Competition, he skyrocketed from being a respected architect to becoming an international celebrity. Although his role in the World Trade Center redesign project has since been diminished, the concepts in his master plan will still be apparent to anyone who visits the memorial after it opens its doors to the public on September 12th. In the meantime, he has many other projects in the works, including the Museum of Military History in Dresden and the Run Run Shaw Creative Media Center in Hong Kong, both of which will open next month. I'm pleased to welcome Daniel Lipskin back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much.
Where were you when you heard about the September 11th attacks?
What a strange encounter of time. I was in Berlin. You know, I had lived in Berlin for 13 years. I moved in 1989 before the wall fell down in order to build the Jewish Museum in Berlin. And September 11th, 2001, I went to my office in Berlin and I said to the people, this is the first time I don't really have to think about the history because this is the day the museum opens to the public. First day, it opens its door after 13 years. And
a lot of controversy and trauma.
A lot of controversy, trauma. We'll get to that later.
So
the museum opens and, you know, I say, you know, what a great day for me. You know, people can encounter that history on their own. And then, of course, around 2:30 Berlin time, we saw those images, and the museum closed its doors for the next 3 days. And I suddenly realized you can never say that history is kind of over; everything's interconnected.
Did you feel like an American again? Because your history is interesting. You were born in Poland, but you came to the United States, lived here for a while, were educated here.
Well, I'm an American. I'm a New Yorker.
An American citizen?
No, instantly when I saw those images, I turned to my colleagues, my wife, everyone who was there, and I said, I'm returning to Lower Manhattan. I don't know what I was saying, but I said, I want to be there. And it was an instant visceral reaction that I wanted to be back, not just in New York, but in Lower Manhattan. And luckily for me, I am.
Had you lived here when the original towers were constructed?
Yes, I was a student at Cooper Union. I studied architecture. We used to go down to the site. Very often to see this, mega project being, it was a learning process. Nothing of that sort has ever been built. So, yes, absolutely.
Well, until they were destroyed and took on a new significance, many considered the Twin Towers to be examples of undistinguished architecture. What were your feelings about them?
Well, they were out of scale with New York. And I was not the only one who felt it because, you know, that base truly interrupted. It was kind of a megastructure. And it didn't have the liveliness on the ground level that New York streets had. So it was very controversial. But in time, people got used to it and it was even beloved.
I was most aware of them when they were gone. I would look out the window where they... I could see them from my apartment, and there was an empty space. I felt like there was something was missing there.
Well, of course, they were. You know, I had an experience. My brother-in-law worked in those buildings many years ago. I went with my son Noam, who was 5 years old, and he ran into one of the elevators, and the elevator went up, and I suddenly realized I was not in a building. I was in a city. How was I ever going to find him? Luckily, he got to one of those floors and stood there. But yeah.
Well, when those buildings went up, I was reminded of something Frank Lloyd Wright once proposed for the city. He said we should knock down all the buildings, put up these 2-mile-high buildings. I don't know if you ever heard about that, because I know you're a Frank Lloyd Wright freak.
Yeah.
And that we should put all the businesses in those 2 buildings and then do... One-story residences that cover the rest of the city.
Well, it's a typical arrogance of architects to propose things that nobody would ever want to live in. But it's a kind of modernist utopian idea that history does not exist and only the new does.
What had brought you to the United States in the first place? You were an accordion player at the time?
I was an accordion player. I won the America-Israel Prize when I was in Israel. You know, I came from Poland via Israel to New York. But the real reason was my father, who came from a large Jewish family in Poland, had his only surviving sister who survived Auschwitz here in America, and he was determined to get to America. And so I was an immigrant, like many others.
Well, the accordion is making a comeback. Do you ever regret dropping it as a serious instrument? You, if I understand correctly, once... played alongside Yitzhak Perlman.
Well, I won the award. You know, the America's Repress was to get... I won it the same year with Yitzhak Perlman. There were not too many winners. It was just, you know, 5-6 people. And I remember Isaac Stern, who was the head of the jury, together with Zeno Franciscati, Mrs. Kosovic, saying, why are you playing this vertical piano? What about the horizontal? And of course, you know, I was a virtuoso. I supported my family. I earned a lot more money, I think, when I was an accordionist than now.
Well, it also was a reason that you came to architecture late, wasn't it?
It was. You know, my interests shifted, you know. And by the way, I have to mention here why I played the accordion, because it's not really what I wanted. I lived in Poland, as you said, and under the sort of grayness of anti-Semitism, my parents, I wanted to play the piano. They were too scared to bring a piano to the courtyard because of our neighbors. So they brought me the accordion and said, here's a piano inside a suitcase, hidden. So that was my fate. But probably because I played the accordion, not the piano, I wound up being an architect.
Well, how old were you when you entered the architecture program at Cooper Union?
I was 17, something like that.
Oh, so
yeah,
just the normal process.
Yes, yes.
And then you even worked briefly, very briefly, with Richard Meier and Peter Eisenman.
Well, I had great mentors, great teachers, and I worked there a while, and I kind of didn't like it too much. I thought, you know, I'd follow another path.
Which was what?
Which was not to
teach.
Through teaching, that was one, and drawing. I wasn't an academic, and because I continued to draw and kind of invent things. But I just didn't like the routinized notion of the kind of offices that I was familiar with. I thought one day I'll be lucky, I'll be able to work in a different way, in a more experimental, more open-minded, more laboratory-like way. And that's indeed, I was happy that happened to me.
Well, that's something that happened in architecture around that time with people like Rem Koolhaas and others. So was it in the air? People didn't want to just do the old-fashioned kinds of buildings?
It was in the air in a sense of kind of rejection of a certain kind of corporate world of top-down architecture. But it was also yes, you're right. We're living in a renaissance of architecture. People rediscovered that architecture is not just something private.
But there was also the postmodern period, which was a rejection of modernism. Yeah. And now postmodernism has been rejected. And what we're seeing now is people like you and Zaha Hadid and Frank Gehry doing things that nobody would have imagined trying to build 30 years ago.
How lucky. You know, we live in a period where people can. I mean, I think that's why I think people are interested in architecture again, because it's no longer just a bunch of boxes on the horizon, but it's about people. It's about what they want.
But didn't you come up with a number of projects that people said were impossible to build because of that?
Of course. Well, you know, if you come to architecture from the philosophical idea, from the idea, from a historical idea, from a social idea, you don't start thinking about, you know, 2x4s and, you know, how much a building costs. You think about space. You think about context. So surely you don't think the same way then that a plumber or an infrastructure person would think. You think of architecture as a cultural discipline, which it is. And it's even a storytelling discipline because it has to tell something.
But the problem is you then have to convince somebody to give you money to build this thing that you think would be really fascinating, but they're not so sure.
You know, my first project, the very first project, I never built anything before the Jewish Museum. And, you know, I always say it's pretty easy to win a competition. It's usually a ticket to oblivion. But to build a building, you know, to stick for it and to convince people that it is something worth building, that's really the art of architecture. And I was lucky in that way.
Well, you were teaching. Where were you teaching before you moved to Berlin?
I had my own kind of independent institute in Milan, in Italy. Really out of my home, you know, teaching people who are not wanting to go to offices nor wanted to go to sort of graduate schools and study architecture academically. So it was kind of an alternative. I called it architecture intermundium, kind of between the worlds.
And you were 52 years old when your first project was built. Were you competing with Philip Johnson for the Late Start Award?
Well, I'm a late bloomer, my wife always tells me. But, you know, it's never too late. You know, my mother taught me that. You know, in 5 years, you can do whatever you want if you put your mind to it. And, you know, if you're 95, maybe you don't have the 5 years. But, you know, 52, you have the 5 years.
My guest is Daniel Libeskind, the architect, master planner of the 2003 World Trade Center Design Competition. Most of your buildings are asymmetrical, incorporate jagged lines. So where did that aesthetic come from?
Well, life is jagged. We don't live in symmetries except, you know, when we go to sleep. So architecture has to reflect something more than just, you know, the formulas.
You mentioned the Jewish Museum in Berlin. That was one of your first major projects. But didn't that almost not get built?
Yes. Oh, it was very difficult to build it. It was a new kind of building. it spoke about something else than just, you know, another atrium and another set of exhibition. It spoke about the history of Jews in Germany. It spoke about the abyss. Created spaces that were really unprecedented to communicate an unprecedented event, but also to give hope that this is a new city.
But you wanted to create a feeling of oppression through building.
I wanted to tell the story of, first of all, of the exile of Jews out of Berlin, of the murder, of the end of Berlin in a way, but also of continuity through the kind of stare of hope to the future of Berlin. So, yeah, it's a complex story.
Were you surprised when you received hate mail during the project? Your architecture partner was killed by a letter bomb.
Well, you know, who knows? You know, I never think of these things, but it's of course there are many disturbing events happening that you don't want to know about. Better not to know about them if you want to practice.
Was the killer ever found?
I don't believe so.
Did you learn any lessons about the politics of architecture and what's at stake in designing emotionally charged sites from that experience and a number of others that have occurred since?
I think you have to do what you believe in. You have to faith that what you're doing is not just nonsense. And it's not about you. It's about the content that the building represents, the spaces for people who will be in communication with that content. So it's not really an egotistical profession about a building you want to build. It's about what the building should communicate in a world which needs that message.
We have a couple of clips from Ron Klemenchik, who we interviewed in the days following 9/11, who was then the chairman of the Council on Tall Buildings. Let's listen to one of them.
And back in the 60s, when those buildings were designed, that was kind of the way. That was the thinking as good design practice. Today, our culture has changed. People's attitudes about cities have changed. And I think that if we were to build, if we forget about rebuilding for a second, but if we were just to have a site like that, that was available for development in a location like the south part of Manhattan, that the nature of the development would be very different than a twin 110-story tower.
At that time, there were even people predicting that we would see an end to skyscrapers. Yeah. Of course, many have been built since, yeah. And that to some degree was addressing that whole thing. How did you hear about the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation's competition to rebuild the World Trade Center? Did you think from the start, I'm going to design a very tall building?
Not at all. First of all, I didn't start in this competition to build a project. I was worried and thought a lot about and was very emotionally involved with those who perished. And I suddenly understood this was not a piece of real estate. Even though it's in the midst of New York, you can't just consider this, you know, an exercise for nice buildings. So I thought about the memorial first and about how to create a civic space. But of course, I knew there would have to be tall buildings. But actually, what I did is I took the density of the two buildings and distributed it into five buildings. I have five towers that kind of have the torch-like echo of the Torch of Liberty to the south, because I wanted to use them as compositional members to decrease the height of buildings, to make really the streets more pleasant to be in, and also yet to reach the 1776 top symbolically of Tower Number 1. So it's a number of different issues, but really, it was the memory and also building a lively, vital city.
There were many people who were concerned about the fact that the original World Trade Towers blocked off all the streets that ran east to west, and you were trying to open it up a bit.
Absolutely. Not only open up, create a kind of a major civic space, which is a pleasant space to be, an intimate space, and also create streets that really connect Fulton and Greenwich that give it the historical liveliness of Lower Manhattan.
Well, you've almost specialized in memorials. Any number of buildings that have that, the Military History Museum in Dresden, the Wheel of Conscience Monument in Halifax, Canada. Did you see this as a way of building a bunch of office buildings, or did you see this?
Not
as
at all.
A memorial?
I started with really, I call it memory foundations, because it is using the memory to create a foundation for a 21st century New York, a new neighborhood open towards the Hudson without the shadows of Wall Street. Connect Tribeca, Battery Park, Chinatown, Wall Street into a new neighborhood and make it a social neighborhood, a civic neighborhood, not just a bunch of tall buildings. But of course, we need also, you know, the places where people work in a 21st century sustainable manner.
Well, it's a big problem when you try to do something like this because there are so many conflicting demands. I remember there was originally talk about putting the drawing center down there, and then people were concerned that they might have an exhibit that would offend the families of the people who perished in the attacks.
Well, there is obviously there is a very powerful museum with a slurry wall down in the bowels in the bedrock, which I think is very significant and important. But I agree with you. We need the cultural institutions, which have to really be embraced by that neighborhood.
So were there any guidelines in the competition?
Yes, there were guidelines about what to create. But I've actually gone beyond the guidelines. For example, my strategy was to offer more public space. Of course, I knew there would be skyscrapers and offices, but the Wedge of Light Plaza, which is an additional public space from Broadway, from Church Street, to the which is now defined by the 846 site when the first tower was struck, and 1028 when the second tower collapsed, which is the center of Calatrava's beautiful station. So I tried to maximize, because I always thought my parents were working people in the sweatshops of New York. They would never be in the towers. They'd be on the streets and the subways. What does this site mean to normal people in New York? And that's what I wanted to do, create something interesting.
And you did some lobbying for your plan, even appearing on talk shows like Oprah. Were you trying to convince people?
No, there was a lot of interest. You know, a lot of New Yorkers, everybody cared. It's not just about a person's idea, what they want to do. There's so many stakeholders, you know, beyond the families of victims. You've got the governors, you've got the port authority, you've got the investors with their own architects, you've got the path authorities, you've got the subway, you've got a mayor of New York. So you have to bring them together and create a consensus to build something.
And there were people who were saying we should just leave this as a wreck to remember. And others were suggesting that we just rebuild the Twin Towers exactly as they were, as a way of saying you're not going to get us.
Yeah. No, I think it was not possible. You know, but as I said, it's not possible to rebuild the two towers because people perished on that side. You can't do that again. But you still have to reaffirm the values of New York. And, you know, to me, the symbolic aspects, whether it's the Wedge of Light, the 1776, the slurry wall and the bedrock out of which the buildings rise, are not like cute references. They are really the visceral encounter with the site for people who will have seen it only on TV or in the movies.
So you designed this Wedge of Light that was a way of honoring the memory forever?
Honoring the memory in the skyline of New York, also bringing St. Paul's Chapel into the composition, which I believe is a beautiful church, significant historically, for the founders of our country, and also opened the site towards Broadway, towards the east side, so create a connectivity.
And you came up with a specific height.
Yes, I thought, this is not going to be the tallest tower in the world. Who cares about tallest towers in the world? We care about something that makes sense when you look at a skyline. I said, the Declaration of Independence is not just a cute number that you should remember, but 1776 was the first document to give human rights in the world. So I thought, yes, that's a significant crown of the building, because the building is not 150 stories high. It's actually, as I planned it in the massing of the master plan, a classical tower. It's not a 150-story tower, but I wanted to make it really visible as the hinge of the other four towers which descend from it.
And although the plan has been changed, it's still going to be 1,776 feet tall.
Absolutely. Plus, it's going to have what I suggest in the master plan, platforms for public at the old World Trade Center height. So, yes, and I fought for the footprint of the tower to be not so massive, so there'd be a lot of public space around the memorial.
In the early stages of planning, didn't you run up against some practical constraints like budgetary issues? And
I would assume the bureaucracy was a constant problem. No, I'm a very practical architect. I know that, you don't. It's easy to draw something. The idea is, how do you get it built? So you have to be very practical, but you have to also communicate something. It's not just about a bunch of steel and glass, and it's about what is that space to people? How does that space radiate in every angle, in every perspective, something emotionally meaningful to people?
But things keep on being adjusted because of money. Calatrava's original plan, which I thought was just gorgeous, has been cut back because people felt it was going to be too expensive.
Of course. But architecture has to respond. You know, it's not, you know, if you want your drawings to be in a museum, that's another thing. But if you want to do something and move forward, you have to be able to have a certain flexibility to adapt your design to, of course, changing conditions. And we know that architecture is not designed in a vacuum. You know, it's part of the real world, so we have to adapt.
And do you think that if it were being designed today, we would see something, a totally different process because 10 years have passed? The feelings are a little less raw.
That's interesting. But I think people have very strong feelings to the site. I pass the site every morning and every evening to work and home. And I see people standing and looking. There is a longing. There is a desire to see something more than just a bunch of, you know, commercial, you know, towers. So, yes, I think people want to see the site as meaningful.
And that's why we're still seeing a debate over whether a mosque should be allowed to be created nearby.
Well, I think that's not a question for anybody. You know,
keep on getting emails from people who are still going out there to protest.
I have to tell you, this mosque is not at ground zero. You know, it's, you know, I live in the streets up. You know, you know, this is America. This is there's a separation of church and state. There is liberty. I don't believe it has anything to do with ground zero at all. No.
My guest is Daniel Libeskind, and we're talking about his plans for you weren't calling it the Freedom Tower.
Well, the governor called it Freedom Tower, but it was really the Massive Memory Ground Zero. It was Memory Foundations.
And even though the LMDC chose your design, David Childs of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill has done the final design.
That's right.
Because there was a fear that your building or any building would be too vulnerable to another attack?
That's not true. No, not at all. No, when you're a conductor of an orchestra or a composer of a piece of music, you don't choose the cellist, the violinist, the tuba player. You know, as a composer of the plan, you know, I have to work with everybody who's there. You know, they're the architects, they're the investors, they're the different authorities. But what you have to make sure is that what you have drawn in the master plan can be built, which is really not just a bunch of figures in a plan. It's a three-dimensional, spatial, cultivated plan that has to do with memory. And I think that's what it is. That's what's getting built, and the buildings are beautiful.
Well, as I understand it, the new building has been incredibly expensive because there are so many safety features that have had to have been developed for it. New ways of making glass, new ways of pouring concrete.
Well, who's ever going to question the need for security? The whole project, as you remember, stopped for a while because there were disagreements. We have to make the building secure, but also sustainable in terms of how they sort of economize on the energy and don't waste energy that 20th century buildings did.
Do you think that this means skyscrapers from now on will be drawing from this experience?
Absolutely. I think certainly we don't have a choice whether to build high, because high density living, sustainable living, we don't want to expand the suburbs, continue using cars. I mean, the whole nonsense of just spreading development doesn't make sense. Creativity is in a condensed high density living. So skyscrapers will continue to be built. We just have to build them better. We have to build them safer. We have to build them more beautiful.
Well, this did afford you many opportunities. Suddenly you were being called upon to build, to design things you might not have otherwise. And in 2008, you caused a stir by declaring that you wouldn't work in countries with totalitarian governments, specifically China, for example. But haven't you designed the Run Run Shaw Creative Media Center in Hong Kong?
Yes, but maybe that's too strong. You know, it was a personal aversion to communism. But, you know, I've come to learn that, you know, it's more about people you work with. And you have to feel that you're working with people that you appreciate, admire. It's not really, you know, I'm probably wrong about generalizing about, you know, politics, ideology, because humanity doesn't develop that way. But China has always interested me. And there's no doubt that there are people in China who want to create a better place, a more open society. And I'm all for it, absolutely.
Well, there are some places that seem to have better architecture than others. It almost seems to be a city policy to have great architecture in Chicago, let's say. Are you seeing that in other parts of the world, these boom areas like some of the cities of China or India?
Well, I think every city is a mirror of its occupants. It's every city is beautiful. Even cities that are kind of considered ugly. I'm working in Warsaw. I'm from Poland. People say, "Oh, it's a devastated city," but there is a beauty in that fact that this city, such a beautiful city, was bombed by the Nazis, has come back to life. The shadows of communism are gone. There is a new world. So architecture provides, I think, that hope, provides that movement forward, and I think that's what I love about architecture.
A caller asks if you feel that developing buildings and often space on the land, the World Trade Center site, has slowed New York's healing process. Would we have come together more quickly if the land had been reserved as a national monument?
I don't think you can create just a monument by itself. You have to have, you can't alter, and that was always my worry in the balancing act of the master plan. You can't suddenly shift New York, Lower Manhattan, to a sad place where people cry and it's just pessimistic. You have to balance the need to remember, but use that memory to do something really incredible and move New York forward with its pluralistic culture, with its fun streets, with its incredible people, with its energy forward. So that's the art of that of the balance.
I often wonder about how architects ever find the time to really create. You recently wrote a piece in the New York Times about how often you have to travel for work. And my sense of architects is often that they are explaining the project to the potential client rather than actually having much time at the drawing board.
You know, you have to have an inspiration, but you have to understand that architecture is part of the human world. It's not some elite thing that you sit as an artist and do something for yourself. You have to engage with people. You have to engage with difficulties. And that wrestling produces better buildings.
So you wind up drawing on napkins on airplanes.
Yeah, any chance I have to use any paper in desperation, I do. And, you know, I don't care whether I'm using nice paper or bad paper or where I am. If you have an idea, you can draw it, and that drawing can give birth to a building, to a city.
Your offices are still very close to the World Trade
Absolutely.
Center site.
Next door, yes.
And so you've been watching the buildings go up.
I see it every day and every night and every morning.
Will you be present at the memorial dedication ceremony?
I certainly will be there.
How do you think it will feel to be walking through this campus that you initially envisioned?
You know, I've walked through it many times throughout, including, you know, very recently. It feels incredible. I have to tell you, it's you know, I'm proud to be part of it, but it's really a kind of a New York space where you see a new vista of New York, where you feel a different kind of energy, something about that past, but also something about the future. And you feel that this terrorism did not diminish New York. It made New York into a more social space. It gave it a power to resonate culturally in a different direction. And I think that's all for the positive. I feel that when I'm on the site.
There were people who left. Many of them are coming back. But others, as you say, felt a new sense of community.
You know, there's twice the number of people living in Lower Manhattan today than before the attacks. And I see new families. I see people coming back to work. And, you know, the place is really the rebuilding is catalyzing the growth of Lower Manhattan into a real neighborhood, which it needs to be.
And buildings themselves develop a sense of community.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that real people, it's not just, you know, Wall Street at night where lights go out, but we need more culture. We need more housing, affordable and so on. But it's happening. And I enjoy living there.
Just one more thing. There was a feeling that downtown might go through a renaissance, but a lot of the office spaces are now being converted into housing because of problems downtown, especially in the financial community. Do you see this as a problem for the future?
No, I think it's fantastic. I think the grade B office buildings are turning into housing, and we have new, you know, possibilities of new towers that are really sustainable. So I think it's an organic development where New York is, Lower Manhattan is coming back as a real place to live.
Thank you so much for being with
us
again, Daniel Lipskin.
Thank you so much.